You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Google Gemini. With the Gemini app, you can talk live and have a real-time conversation with an AI assistant. It's great for all kinds of things, like if you want to practice for an upcoming interview, ask for advice on things to do in a new city, or brainstorm creative ideas. And by the way, this script was actually read by Gemini. Download the Gemini app for iOS and Android today. Must be 18 plus to use Gemini Live.
This is the energy of electrification. Available Type S high-performance variant with nearly 500 horsepower and 278-mile EPA range rating. Choose from our complimentary charging packages so you can charge how you want. The all-electric Acura ZDX. This is the energy of innovation. Acura, precision-crafted performance. Count down to the new year in the all-electric Acura ZDX with $0 first month's payment and $1 due at signing.
...2024 has been a truly notable year when it comes to space news.
Disturbances in the Earth's magnetic field produced a spectacular show by the Northern Lights.
And many lucky viewers got to see a solar eclipse sweep across North America as the moon briefly blocked the sun.
And it is so beautiful. The sky suddenly darkens in the middle of the day, and birds and animals are completely confused. People who have seen a total eclipse say it really is one of the most exciting things in terms of the sights that they have seen.
And as the year wraps, the celestial spectacles haven't stopped. Just this month, a scientist reopened a cold case about the planet Uranus.
So during the flyby in 1986, Voyager 2 flew past the planet and measured its magnetic field and observed two very striking mysteries from its measurements.
If his solutions to those mysteries are accurate, they may fundamentally alter our 40-year-old understanding about our faraway gassy neighbor. I'm Seth Shostak, and this is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, we're looking back at a year of incredible astronomical phenomena, imagining a Jupiter flyby, and with luck, unraveling a mystery that has long shrouded one of the largest planets in our solar system. This is 2024, Our Space Odyssey.
It's always inspiring to walk outside and look at the sky. Celestial phenomena reliably wow us, but this was a year of great spectacle.
An unusual number of people were treated to a show by the Northern Lights.
Wow! Look behind you!
Holy cow, they're everywhere, huh? Wow, dude! Wow!
As someone who has made a career observing the sky, I have to admit I had never seen the Aurora Borealis.
Seth, how is that possible? You're an astronomer.
Well, I mean, even an astronomer can't see through the clouds, and they were always in the way.
What about in the southern hemisphere? Have you ever seen the aurora there?
Yeah, the Aurora Australis. No, I haven't seen it there either. So I have to say, when I finally did see it, it was really a treat to see the greens, purples, and reds shimmering across the sky.
And it seems as if we have been craning our necks toward the sky all year. In April, a solar eclipse plunged part of North America into darkness for several minutes.
One astrophysicist could hardly contain her excitement at a viewing party in Illinois.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Okay,
here we go.
Now, you'd be forgiven if the eclipse and the Northern Lights were the only astronomical highlights that you remember from the year, but 2024 brought us much more.
Including this appearance on Big Picture Science by a friend of the show, Andrew Fracknoy, a professor of astronomy at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco. He talks about the celestial events and astronomical discoveries that thrilled him this year.
Now, as an astronomer, Andy, we've talked to you about many eclipses. You've never held back on your enthusiasm for eclipses. But what made this one special?
Well, I think what made this one so exciting is that so many people in the big picture science listening area were able to see it. I was very fortunate to be one of the leaders of the project to distribute 6 million eclipse glasses free through 15,000 public libraries. And I think that enabled a much larger group of people to have a chance to observe the eclipse safely. Also, the weather miraculously cooperated, particularly in the northeastern part of the United States. Places that were usually cloudy in April, the skies cleared for this celestial spectacle.
You have always urged the public to go and observe an eclipse. And this was a total eclipse of the sun. And why do you do that? Why do you think it's important for the public to see it?
In terms of what an eclipse is, it's that the moon gets in front of the sun and covers it completely. And that turns out to be a remarkable cosmic coincidence. If you look at all the planet-moon combinations in the solar system, the other moons are either too small or too big to cover the sun from their location. And so you really have to come to Earth to be able to see a total eclipse of the sun. And it is so beautiful. The sky suddenly darkens in the middle of the day, and birds and animals are completely confused. People who have seen a total eclipse say it really is one of the most exciting things in terms of the sights that they have seen.
What you said about Earth being the spot in the solar system in which to observe a total eclipse, if we were on Jupiter and the moon, one of its moons passed in front of the sun, it would not have the same effect.
That's right. And in fact, the rovers on Mars have confirmed this, because the rovers on Mars have cameras that have actually captured one of the moons of Mars eclipsing the sun, and it's much too small to cover it. So it's kind of a pathetic eclipse as compared to a spectacular eclipse.
And when is the next time we might see a total solar eclipse in North America?
Well, that's the problem. From the continental United States, I'm sorry to report that the next total eclipse will be August 12th, 2045.
45, well.
45, so take your vitamins, make sure you're still around.
Well, another sky spectacle was the Northern Lights. And Andy, I have to tell you, I was in New York on Long Island in October with my family. And my husband, who was standing on the porch long past sunset, said, "Everybody, come look at the sky. What is that glow?" And of course, we identified it as the Aurora Borealis, but it caught everyone by surprise. And I believe that's because the Northern Lights were viewed much further south than usual.
That's right. So let me set the background for this. The sun has activity, seething activity on its surface, and that activity becomes more and less on a regular 11-year cycle. So over the 11 years, the sun goes through what we call maximum activity, and then minimum activity, and then back to maximum. And in 2024 and 25, we are at the point of maximum solar activity. That means that the sun can give off what the astronomers call coronal mass ejections, CMEs. These are parts of the sun where a whole package, as I say, a whole batch of hot charged particles is thrown off the sun in a magnetic event. And those particles can travel outward from the sun at great speed. Most of those emitted particles turn out to be emitted in the direction of some random place in space where there's nothing in the way. But every once in a while, one of those ejections can be pointed directly at the Earth. And then the vast flow of particles from the sun can overwhelm the protective magnetic bottle that the Earth has. The Earth itself is a magnet, and its magnet protects us from charged particles from space. But when we get one of these ejections coming directly toward us, it can overwhelm the ability of the Earth to protect us, and particles from the sun come down and hit the Earth's atmosphere. And when the atmosphere is hit by a fast-moving energetic particle, the molecules of air begin to glow.
Andy, what accounts for the different colors? Because sometimes the northern lights are kind of a blue or a green. This was more, what we saw was more in the reddish, pinkish area.
And that's because the Earth's atmosphere is made up of molecules of different types. And each molecule, when it's hit, cries out with light in a different frequency, in a different kind of color. And so if you have oxygen molecules being hit, you get one kind. If you have nitrogen, you get another color. And so the different elements in the atmosphere of the Earth account for the different colors that we see.
Well, let's move on to phenomena that we can't see without a telescope. Mars was in the news because a new volcano was discovered on the Red Planet early in the year, in March, I believe. Now, this is not an active volcano, of course. So what drew the attention of planetary scientists? How do you spot a volcano on another planet if it's not active in emitting stuff?
Well, this was a great story because this was a volcano that was hidden in plain sight. So it turns out to be a volcano which is quite eroded. It's in that general region of Mars where we've seen giant volcanoes, but this volcano was kind of hidden by the geological structure it had and by the neighborhood it was in. And so we missed it because it's kind of eroded and in complicated terrain. And then this year, a team of astronomers led by Pascal Lee of the SETI Institute announced that they had examined data from 7 different satellites simultaneously and really looked at it closely. And they found that there was this eroded volcano 280 miles in diameter. So this is not a small mountain. It's not as big as the biggest volcano on Mars, but it's a pretty respectable size, 280 miles in diameter. It rose once upon a time some 30,000 feet in elevation. So climbing it would be non-trivial. And there it was in the area near Noctis Labyrinthus, the labyrinth of night. So we call this the Noctis volcano for now. And it's really nice to be able to add such a large volcano to the repertoire of interesting features on Mars.
The lead author on the study of the volcano, as you mentioned, is Pascal Lee. He's a SETI planetary scientist. And that suggests, Andy, that there is a SETI angle to this discovery. Could you share with us the connection between a volcano on Mars and the hunt for alien life?
Well, certainly one of the things that we're interested in is whether or not the Earth is the only place in our own solar system where the steps leading to life began. And of the places that we think are good candidates for having a what we might call a second genesis, a separate beginning of life, Mars is very high on our list. We know now from the study of Mars and the pictures that people have analyzed that there's good evidence that ancient Mars was quite different from Mars today. Today, Mars is a dry planet with a very thin atmosphere. Water would not exist in liquid form on the surface. But we think ancient Mars might well have been a place much more like the Earth, with a thicker atmosphere, with water able to be liquid and to pool on the surface, with a warmer temperature. So it may have been that there were lakes and oceans on Mars billions of years ago, and it was a kind of fertile environment for a separate start to life.
So that's interesting because it sounds like you're saying that we're interested in the volcanoes on Mars because we're interested in the geology of Mars and we're interested in painting a picture of what Mars was once like, which was an active planet. It had geologic activity. It was wetter. But I thought you might say that we're interested in the volcanoes because volcanoes are very mineral rich and they're hot. And that might be a place where life could get a start.
Right, probably not inside the volcano, but that the volcano might provide the kind of energy that leads to chemical combinations which are the steps in the path to life.
Well, finally, Andy, continuing the theme of massive astronomical phenomena that are able to spew large amounts of material from a concentrated point. Can you guess where I'm going with this?
I think I can, but please.
I understand that a particularly interesting and active supermassive black hole was discovered this year.
Right. So we, again, should set the background for our listeners. A black hole, you might have heard, is something that happens when a star dies. A star collapses at the end of its life under its own gravity until it gets so squozen, can I use that technical term, that not even light can escape. The gravity is so strong that not even light can escape. If not even light can escape, if you throw something in, you'll never see it again, and light can't come out, so the color is black. So we call these objects black holes. And black holes, you might imagine, are very difficult to find because they're black and you can't see anything from them. But in fact, black holes are discoverable when they eat, when they draw in material from another star or from raw material in their neighborhood. Then that material, before it falls in, before it ever gets swallowed by the black hole, can glow with tremendous energy as it swirls around the black hole. And those accretion disks, those regions of food about to fall into the black hole, are visible to us.
So this particular black hole that was found this year is quite voracious. And does it have a name? And what makes it a particularly hungry black hole? Or if you don't know the nature of why it's like that, what is it doing and where is it?
No, absolutely. So let me make sure we understand what's going on. You asked for the name, and I'm really sorry about that, but the name is a catalog number. So it's J0529-4351, an extremely unromantic name. But never mind, it's a distant galaxy that we're seeing 12 billion light years away. So we're actually seeing this black hole as it was 12 billion years ago. It has already eaten 17 billion suns worth of material. And what we're observing as this doomed material swirls around the black hole just before it gets eaten, we're observing that this black hole is eating the equivalent of one sun every single day. Think about that. A black hole so large and so hungry that it can eat an entire sun's worth of material every single day. This is the fastest eating black hole that astronomers have ever discovered.
Andy, where does all that material go? If the black hole is absorbing, gobbling up objects, what happens to that matter?
This, now you're asking the question that bedeviled Einstein as well. So Einstein asked this question, if there really are such things, where does the material go? And he actually, with a colleague, posited that these black holes might be tunnels to elsewhere or elsewhen. They're called Einstein-Rosen bridges. Today, scientists and science fiction fans call them wormholes, places where gravity might enable you to go to places you normally couldn't go. But this is all speculation, because a black hole is black and no one can see inside a black hole. No one knows what happens inside a black hole. So I have to be really honest and say that that's a question to which neither I nor any other astronomer has an answer.
It's the original black box. The black hole is the original black box. We don't know. Well, Andy, this has been just a wonderful summary of astronomical stories from 2024. It is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Fracknoy is a professor of astronomy at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco.
Coming up, a plasma physicist who believes our understanding of the gas giant Uranus may have been wrong for the last 40 years.
This past year has been a whirlwind of recent discoveries, all answering different mysteries surrounding Uranus since the Voyager 2 flyby.
This episode is 2024, our Space Odyssey.
Get ready, because Clear the Rack is on at your Nordstrom Rack store. Now through Thursday, find incredible deals on wear now styles on sale for even less at Nordstrom Rack. Take an extra 25% off Red Tag clearance throughout the store from brands like UGG, Vince, Stuart Weitzman, AG, and more. All sales final. The best stuff goes fast. So shop this sale at Nordstrom Rack today. Please see NordstromRack.com or ask a store associate for details.
Nearly 40 years ago, space probe Voyager 2 zipped by the seventh planet in our solar system, passing it at the blistering speed of more than 30,000 miles per hour.
That NASA spacecraft went on to capture the first close-up pictures of Uranus. It continued on and nabbed shots of Neptune as well. It's the only spacecraft to have ever reached these two distant ice giants. Uranus and Neptune are over 1.7 billion miles from Earth.
The journey of Voyager 2 finally allowed scientists to observe these planets and their moons close up and get a better understanding of their composition, their formation, and whether they might or ever could have supported life. Uranus has a whopping number of moons, 28.
But data that the Voyager probe sent back from Uranus surprised scientists. Something was odd about its magnetosphere, that is, the protective bubble created by a planet's magnetic field. The energized particles in the magnetic field trap incoming radiation from the sun. We're grateful for that effect on Earth, as it protects life from those intense and dangerous rays. But scientists discovered that the magnetic field around Uranus was oddly lopsided, and it had an unusually low amount of plasma, which is to say, hot gas. If so, that would make Uranus a total oddball in our solar system. But it also suggested something about five of the moons whose orbits are within the magnetosphere.
Nearly every active moon in our solar system ejects water vapor. That vapor gets trapped by the planet's magnetic field, and researchers look for it to study the interaction between a planet and its moons. Voyager was unable to detect any gas in Uranus's magnetic field, which suggested that there was no water vapor on its five major moons. And that suggested that the moons were sterile. But what if the oddball wasn't the Uranus system, but the Voyager data itself?
I'm Jamie Jasinski. I'm a space plasma physicist at JPL.
Dr. Jasinski led the effort at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory to re-examine those 40-year-old data.
So during the flyby in 1986, Voyager 2 flew past the planet and measured its magnetic field, and observed two very striking mysteries from its measurements. So the first thing it observed was that inside the magnetic field, that magnetic bubble that we call the magnetosphere, there was no charged gas from the moons. So we expect these moons, which are icy, to be essentially giving off water into the system or interacting with the local environment, and you can observe this water in the magnetic field because it becomes trapped as a charged gas. But we didn't observe anything like that. We actually observed a completely empty magnetic field, and we've been calling it a vacuum magnetosphere for the last 40 years. And that was very strange, and because we expect these moons to be active and we observe no water from them. So the other second big mystery is, if we have this very empty magnetosphere, why do we observe these very intense belts of radiation? So very close to the planet, you have these very energetic particles, and they are the second most intense radiation system in the whole entire solar system. So Jupiter has the most intense radiation belt, and then Uranus is the close second. And the big mystery behind that observation was, where are these particles coming from if we have a magnetic field that is essentially called a vacuum, and they exist without a possible explanation?
Well, you've already pointed out that Voyager 2 flew by Uranus in 1986. That's nearly three dozen years ago or something like that. And there were only about, I don't know what it was, 5 hours worth of data collected from Uranus. So that's kind of the sum total of the data we have that's taken from something other than the ground here, or from, the space telescope, which isn't too far above the ground. So everything we know about Uranus derives from that close encounter, pretty much. I mean, we've never sent a spacecraft to deliberately target this world?
No. So the only exploration locally made by a spacecraft is the Voyager 2 flyby in 1986, like you mentioned. The flyby lasted 5 days. So 5 hours is depending on which instrument team you ask about the data. In terms of the magnetic field, it's about 5 days worth of data. And the understanding we have of Uranus is shaped and based largely off that flyby from 38 years ago.
So your recent paper about Uranus, Jamie, if you had to explain that to the guy sitting next to you on the bus, and he asked, what's in it? How would you explain that in under a minute?
So the two mysteries I just mentioned about the empty magnetic field and the intense radiation belts can now be explained essentially as activity from the sun smashing into Uranus and driving dynamics. So just before Voyager 2 got to Uranus, activity from the sun created an enhancement in the solar wind, which hit the planet's magnetic field, compressed it to about 20% of the size. And this strong compression can actually push any water from the moons out of the system. So you could essentially wipe the slate clean and completely eradicate any evidence from the moons. And so this idea that we've been using, that we didn't see any water in the magnetic field of Uranus, means that these moons are active, is no longer valid. And so we can actually go back and start revisiting the idea that these moons may have subsurface oceans and may be active. The other explanation for the radiation belts is somewhat similar. If you compress this magnetic field and you're driving those particles out, you can actually drive them into the radiation belts to be energized and then drive the rest out of the system. So we temporarily observed, for just the few days that Voyager 2 was there, a system that's not really representative of what is generally happening at Uranus.
So, Jamie, what you're saying then is that our view of Uranus was kind of biased by the timing of the Voyager 2 flyby. I mean, the scientists expected to find charged particles in the magnetosphere, but they didn't. And the reason seems to be that the probe chanced to fly by during a period of high solar activity. We didn't realize 40 years ago that the sun was battering Uranus with these strong solar winds. We only saw the effects, which were to blow away all the gases within Uranus's magnetic field and squash that field down, making it appear smaller than it normally is, and also lopsided.
Yes, so the 5 days we got from the flyby is not your typical Uranus. We just managed to catch it at the wrong place and at the wrong time, depending on how you look at it.
You've said, Jamie, that if the Voyager 2 had arrived just a week earlier, just a week, our understanding of Uranus would be completely different.
Yes, if we had arrived a week earlier, we would have observed Uranus and its magnetic field in a slightly different configuration than what was observed during the flyby a week later. So I mentioned the solar wind earlier on. The solar wind, the plasma that comes from the sun, it hits every magnetic field and planet along the way, and it hit Uranus's magnetic field just before Voyager 2 got there. And there was this big enhancement in the solar wind, so it compressed that magnetic field to about 20% of the size that it was a week earlier. So we saw this much smaller magnetic bubble, or what we call a magnetosphere, than what we would have observed a week earlier. So that sort of big dramatic compression of the magnetic field can drive a lot of different dynamics, and will change the measurements that Voyager 2 took at the time.
as a planet, we call it a gas giant because it is big and its outer layers are all gas. I think they're mostly methane, ammonia, and water. But beyond that, what would you say about Uranus that's really remarkable?
One of the things, the obvious part is obviously is that it's on its side. So all the planets, they rotate whilst orbiting the sun. But because Uranus is on its side, it's essentially rolling around the sun. And it's one of its poles during the summer is facing directly at the sun. So it's permanently in sunlight. And then as it orbits around the sun and the pole then faces away from the sun, it's in perpetual darkness for half of the Uranian year almost.
Well, how did it get that way? I mean, you know, as you point out, all those spin axes of the other planets are more or less, you know, up and down with regard to the ecliptic. But Uranus is on its side. You know, it didn't choose to do that, did it?
No. So one of the most accepted ideas currently is that it was impacted by a large object in its early formation during the formation of the solar system. A more recent idea has been proposed, which is backed by computer simulations, is that actually you can also turn it on its side by a large satellite, so a moon that's only about a thousandth of the size of the planet. And if it's slowly migrating away from the planet, it can slowly turn that axial tilt so it's facing towards the sun. This is a more recent idea. The tipping in the early formation of the solar system is a bit more difficult to explain because there you would have to also explain sort of why, I guess, Neptune is unaffected when it's a bit more further out, if there was some kind of early effect on Uranus. But this new idea of it being a gravitational effect by an old ancient moon of Uranus could also explain why it's on its side now.
Jamie, if, for example, the North Pole of Uranus is facing the sun for, you know, half a Uranus year, and then away from the sun, I mean, I would think that would lead to really weird weather, insofar as weather is a thing on Uranus.
Yeah, and I guess one of the big questions has been recently also for the last 40 years is why the temperature has been changing in the thermosphere of Uranus. So at Voyager 2, we observed a temperature in 1986 when the spacecraft flew past the planet. And then since then, over the last 40 years, the temperature of the planet and its atmosphere has been cooling. It's over halved in its temperature. And so that has been a mystery over the last 40 years in itself. But this past year has been a whirlwind of recent discoveries, all leading to answering different mysteries surrounding Uranus since the Voyager 2 flyby. So one of them being is that the solar wind is actually very important. So the solar wind is plasma coming from the sun that's lost from the sun and is hitting every planet along its way outwards throughout the solar system. And this interaction that Uranus and its magnetic field have with the solar wind is important in answering a whole bunch of different mysteries that we've had since the Voyager 2 flyby.
When do we get another chance?
Hopefully we'll go back soon. The National Academy of Sciences recommended to NASA that the priority in planetary science in the coming decades is to go back to Uranus. So now NASA is focusing on a potential future mission to go back to Uranus and orbit the planet and its moons and its magnetic field.
Jamie Jasinski, thanks so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Jamie Jasinski is a space plasma physicist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the author of a recent paper in Nature that re-examines the Voyager 2 data on Uranus. Seth, can you draw the connection between the protective shield, if you will, of a magnetic field and life? Because that may have implications to the case of the mysterious missing magnetic field of Uranus.
So this is kind of interesting because the question of a magnetic field on Uranus has been revised, right? And magnetic fields are actually quite important to planets that might be able to sustain life because, of course, those magnetic fields divert the high-energy particles from the sun that otherwise might, you know, destroy any life on a planet.
Yes, and he said that we might be able to reconsider our notions about subsurface oceans on some of these moons. And, you know, Seth, that allows us to draw a comparison to Titan, the moon of Saturn. And Titan is a target of NASA scientists in their hunt for water.
It is. And the idea that there might be life in the oceans of moons, well, if you had tried to float that idea 30 or 40 years ago, people would kind of smile and laugh, maybe. I don't know. But that's a very distinct possibility now. And I personally find it actually kind of interesting, exciting, and even truly unexpected that when we look for life in space, the best place to look might just be in the oceans of some nearby moons.
Next, how the James Webb Space Telescope has given us a few surprises about the earliest days of the universe.
After the Big Bang, we didn't expect to see these big, gigantic galaxies, which we thought would take upwards of a billion years before they could sort of organize themselves.
That's coming up as we continue with 2024, our Space Odyssey.
Was the nights before Christmas, despite last-minute stress, few were delivering except Walmart Express.
Stockings were hung by the fire with care, knowing in about an hour, stuffers would soon be there.
On to the road, Walmart Express delivery went, chock full of wondrous things in the St. Nick of time sent. Let's go!
Get express delivery in as fast as an hour, even on Christmas Eve. Orders must be placed by 4 p.m. local time on 12/24. Subject to availability. Fees and restrictions apply.
Express delivery to y'all and to all a good night. Welcome to your Walmart.
The James Webb Space Telescope is a true marvel. It has 6 times the light-gathering power of Hubble, which makes it the most powerful telescope shot into space.
Since its launch in 2021, Webb has returned photos of celestial objects like the Carina Nebula, a stunning cloud of dust and gas 7,500 light-years away.
Scientists have put the telescope to work. In a few short years, it has detected organic molecules over 12 billion light-years away, observed the collision of 2 black holes, and shaken up the standard model of cosmology that describes the evolution of the universe along the way. That's all.
Indeed, the year 2024 has further added to Webb's impressive and prolific body of results.
So it's fitting that we discuss them with a prolific writer about Webb and another one of our favorite astronomers, Phil Plait.
One of the things that struck me, Phil, is a cosmological discovery, if you will, and that is that the James Webb Space Telescope saw some big galaxies that are so far away that they're very young, and we didn't expect that in the early part of the universe you'd have big galaxies like that. Maybe you can explain, you know, the observations a little bit. How do we know they're massive, and how do we know they're, you know, very early in the universe, that we're seeing them as they were when they were very young?
Right. Well, JWST, as the observatory is called by those of us in the know, is tuned to see infrared light. And this is light that has a longer wavelength than the human eye can see. Well, that turns out to be very advantageous, because as we look farther away in the universe, we're seeing objects, first of all, as they were a long time ago, because it's just taken a long time for the light to reach us, sometimes billions of years. But over that time, the universe is expanding. The universe is getting bigger, and that stretches out the light from these galaxies. So the farther away they are, the more this light is redshifted. Now, if you were in a galaxy 13 billion light years from Earth, you'd look around and you'd see ultraviolet light flying everywhere. There's very high energy light. But by the time it gets to us here on Earth, it's been stretched way out into the infrared. And a lot of these galaxies cannot be seen by Hubble because Hubble does not see in the infrared. It sees the kind of light our eyes do. Well, JWST looks in the infrared, so it sees these galaxies very well. And that's one of the reasons it was built, was to look at these very distant galaxies and see what it could see. And what it has seen are galaxies that are bigger and brighter and more well-formed, I should say, than we expected. We thought that looking so long ago in the universe, when the universe itself was quite young, we were expecting them to be small and sort of shapeless, irregular, because they form out of all the material that's swirling around after the Big Bang. They wouldn't have had much time, and we're talking about 100 million years, 2, 3, 400 million years, something like that, after the Big Bang. We didn't expect to see these big, gigantic galaxies, which we thought would take upwards of a billion years before they could sort of organize themselves. So to see these big, bright galaxies this early on is interesting.
Okay, so this is like having some sort of, I don't know, way back machine that would allow you to see, well, humans. Looking back to when humans first appeared, you'd expect that, or at least some generation of humans first appeared, you would expect that they were smaller and, you know, they didn't look like fully grown humans, that kind of thing. We look back on the universe, we expect galaxies to be, you know, sort of younger versions of themselves, which is to say smaller and lighter. But they don't seem to be. So, yeah, what's the explanation for that? I mean, I assume it's not because the observations are wrong.
I don't think the observations are wrong. We're seeing a lot of galaxies like this. They're much brighter and bigger than expected. It's more likely there's just this idea of how galaxies form, and we don't have as good a grip on it as we thought. That's not a big deal. That's kind of expected. There are all kinds of ideas we have about the way the universe was when it was very young. And without the observations, what are you going to do? You have to just kind of try to figure things out. Maybe galaxies collided more quickly back then. They were more efficient at gathering material. Maybe there's some physics involved with the way gas flows or stars behave or black holes blast out light that makes it easier for galaxies to construct themselves more quickly. We're going to figure this out. We just don't know what the answer is yet.
There's another story that is kind of, you know, making, if not the headlines, at least is on the front page. And that is the fact that the Small Magellanic Cloud may actually be two galaxies, one behind the other. First, tell us, what is the Small Magellanic Cloud?
Well, we live in the Milky Way galaxy, which is a gigantic spiral galaxy. It's got a flat disk and a halo of stars around it and a lot of other stuff. And it's big. We live in a pretty big galaxy. And it has a lot of satellite galaxies orbiting it, dozens. We're not even sure how many. These are much, much smaller galaxies that orbit around us, much like the moon orbits the Earth. Most of these galaxies are so faint that they were only recently discovered, but a couple of them have actually been known since antiquity, and they are called the Large and the Small Magellanic Clouds. Now, they're visible to the naked eye from the southern hemisphere. I've seen them myself from Australia. They're gorgeous. And you'd think if they're big and bright and you can see them by eye, we'd know a lot about them. And it turns out we don't. Their behavior, a lot of the things about them, is difficult to understand. For one thing, they are a couple of 100,000 light years away, which is a long distance. And that means that the stars inside of them and the gas and all of that, while it's all in motion, that motion is diminished to us by distance. So we don't see them moving very quickly, and it's hard to know what's going on dynamically in these galaxies. Well, with the Small Magellanic Cloud, we know a few things about it. It's 200,000 light years away. It's about 20,000 light years across, so much smaller than the Milky Way. It has a lot of old stars and young stars. It's actively making stars. But as it was being studied recently, astronomers found out some weird things. Now, for example, when they looked at young, massive stars, these are newborn stars that are much more massive than the Sun, and they looked at cold gas, so hydrogen gas, which is actually quite cold, they found that overall, this stuff appears to be rotating around the center of the galaxy, kind of like you'd expect in a disk galaxy, all of this stuff swirling around the center. But when they look at older stars, they found out they aren't. They're just moving every which way like bees flying around a beehive. And that's kind of weird to have two very different populations of stars like this. And the more they looked, the more discrepancies they found. And what the astronomers that did this study have proposed is that, yeah, instead of one small galaxy, it's possibly two small galaxies, one slightly bigger than the other, and one of them just happens to be about 15,000 light years farther away from our point of view. So we're looking through one galaxy, seeing the other one behind it, but they look like one because we are looking directly at them.
So it's just a chance alignment.
That's right. If we were looking from a different angle, we can't because we're stuck inside our galaxy. But if you were to, you know, get aboard your starship and fly 100,000 light years, I don't know, to the left, you could look down and see these two galaxies next to each other. But unfortunately, we are along the line between them, so we see them as one.
What's the cosmic significance of that? Or is it simply, you know, kind of an interesting fact that will affect the studies by future astronomers of this particular object or set of objects?
One of the reasons this is important to astronomers is that these smaller galaxies, in many ways, are similar to the way galaxies were when the universe was young. And so by studying them, even though they're close by, and we're seeing them as they are 13.8 billion years old or whatever, we have a way of sort of studying the early universe by looking at them. They're sort of like a time capsule of that age. So when you're looking at it and you find out, oh gosh, we thought this was one thing and it's actually two, that's going to change how we understand it. That changes how we understand how galaxies behave, how they form, how they grow, and how they evolve over billions of years. So all of this is very important for astronomers to understand how galaxies work. And it's surprising, for example, we always thought they were orbiting the Milky Way, and there has been some recent work studying them over many decades, trying to figure out how they're moving, that shows that maybe not. They may be moving too quickly, and they're really just passing us by. So there are a lot of things about these galaxies we do not understand, even though we can see them very clearly. So studying them really gives us a lot of insight into what's going on in our galactic neighborhood.
Another item here, a last item we might talk about, Phil, the final flight of Ingenuity on Mars. Tell us about Ingenuity, how it got its name, or at least what it is.
Ingenuity is awesome. It's a helicopter. It's a drone, right, on Mars. It was launched with the Perseverance rover, which is currently, you know, wandering around Mars looking for signs of ancient water flow and possible conditions for habitability on Mars billions of years ago. And early on in its mission, it dropped Ingenuity onto the surface of Mars. It was carried underneath the carriage of the rover, dropped it down, and this thing basically was a test bed of engineering. We've never flown an aircraft on Mars like this before. The idea was to test a lot of this technology, and the scientific part of it, or at least the part of the mission that was helping Perseverance, was to fly, for example, ahead of the rover, look at the terrain, look for any sort of traps that might damage the rover, but also to get up high enough to get an overview of the terrain. You know, we send these rovers to Mars, and they're big, they're like golf carts, but they're on the surface. And they look around and they see rocks and they see all kinds of interesting things. But you don't get that view from above that puts everything into context. And it flew over and over again. It was expected to go five flights, I think. They were hoping to get five or fewer than 10 flights out of it. And it just kept going. As everything JPL makes just keeps going. It should be their mission statement. And it flew 72 flights over almost 3 years. And it was on the 72nd flight in January of 2024, when something happened. The tip of one of the blades hit the ground and broke the rotor, basically, is what happened. And the pictures came back from the rover itself of Ingenuity, and it was like, yeah, that's it. It's busted. It's not going to fly again. And it turns out it did a really good job, and people have taken it seriously. We're now going to fly a quadcopter, another kind of helicopter, to a moon of Saturn. And it's possible that we'll be building a lot more of these to go to other objects that have atmospheres. I mean, Mars is a good target for it. Because there's just a ton of science you can do, this thing doesn't take much power. It's not that heavy, so it's not that intensive when you try to get it there. And the return can be quite large.
Finally, Phil, is there some mission coming up in the near future that you're particularly keen on?
We have a mission on the way to Mercury, BepiColombo. This is a joint European and Japanese mission, and it's going to orbit Mercury, and we haven't done this in a long time, so I'm really looking forward to seeing those images. Europa Clipper is on its way to Jupiter. Now, that's going to be a little bit in the future. We haven't seen those moons up close in a long time. And so these giant moons of Jupiter, we still don't know that much about them. And so I'm really looking forward to that. But these are all missions that are being developed. They're in the works, or they're on their way to their targets. And it's just always a joy to think about what we're going to be seeing in the years to come that's going to surprise us or amaze us, or just we're going to look at it and go, this is gorgeous. What a spectacular image of a beautiful object. And sometimes for me, that's enough. I'm lying. It's never enough. I love the science behind it, but I still just, I do love the beauty of space. And so these missions just make my heart sing.
Well, Phil Plait, thank you very much for speaking with us and talking to us about some really exciting things going on in astronomy.
Thanks, Seth. It's always my pleasure.
Phil Plait is an astronomer, author, and a regular contributor to Scientific American. Well, Seth, that brings us to the big picture moment in the show. What were some of the highlights for you this year, astronomical or celestial, otherwise celestial?
Yeah, well, the eclipse to begin with. And I mean, eclipses, you know, used to be very magical if you were born 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. But because today we can, you know, predict them. I mean, you can go to the NASA website and find what's going to happen during the eclipse to the minute. But I was down in Mexico to see the eclipse. You know, some buses took us out into the desert, so it was very clear. And gosh darn, you know, I've seen a lot of eclipses, Molly, but they never fail to impress me, I have to say.
And then what about the James Webb Space Telescope that continues to astound us with its results?
Well, of course, that's interesting, too. The James Webb Telescope, remember, is an infrared telescope. Okay, so, you know, its eyeballs, if you will, can see infrared. Now, you might say, so what? And the so what is that if you look at things that are very far away, because of the expansion of the universe, they appear to be receding away from us. And that means the light from those objects is shifted into the infrared part of the spectrum. So an infrared telescope can find the baby pictures of the universe. So of course that's interesting, yeah.
Well then, what about next year, Seth? Do you have any predictions for 2025? Anything that we should keep our eyes tilted toward the sky for? Or is every year, this is a softball question to an astronomer, or is every year an incredible year for astronomy?
I think the accurate answer to that question, Molly, is that every year is interesting. That's because, of course, of the instrumentation and the understanding that we already have about the cosmos. But that, you know, that is a point. If you were talking to Julius Caesar about, you know, what he sees in the sky, every year would be pretty much the same as the previous year and the previous year to that. We live in a special time where, you know, if you pick up the paper at least once a week, you'll read about special discoveries in astronomy.
Picking up the paper sounds like something Julius Caesar would do, but even if you log on to your favorite news website or scan social media, you'll also be up to date on some of these discoveries.
Rome.com.
This show is thanks to the uneclipsable talents of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and the stellar work of assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards. I am Molly Bentley, the executive producer in Mission Control for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that studies life in all its complexity. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak, and we want to extend a year-end thanks for the phenomenal support of our listeners and our Patreon subscribers.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that looks back at the year in astronomy is called 2024, Our Space Odyssey.
Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. Some of y'all might have heard I made the cross-country move from LA to New York last year, and Wayfair has definitely helped me create the feeling of home wherever I am. I love a cozy couch and a comfy living room that feels like our little sanctuary for our family. And I love vases, I love candles, I love anything that kind of makes you feel at home and peaceful. Anyway, something about me is I love options when it comes to making my home more me. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. Everyone loves a good deal. I mean, who does not want free and fast and easy delivery? Come on. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you. Wayfair, every style, every home.
Tech moves fast. So keep pace with the Daily Crunch podcast from TechCrunch. With new episodes every day, this podcast will give you a quick overview on everything you need and should know about startups, new tech, regulations, and more. Listen to TechCrunch Daily Crunch now, wherever you get your podcasts. That's TechCrunch Daily Crunch, wherever you get your podcasts.